everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stopping, staring, I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast wind, sailing on summer breeze. And skipping over the ocean like a stone. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here at Global Patriot Radio on blogtalkradio.com. It is Wednesday, the 26th of January, 2022. There is some significance as to why I played that song, and when you heard me introduce a little of my own vocalization in there. Anyway, this is Hank Jones Poly Sports at Global Patriot Radio. There are 7 shows on Global Patriot Radio, 1 each day. Mondays, it begins with the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, 6 o'clock every Monday, Eastern Time. Tuesdays, Eric is in with the Cross and Crescent discussion. That's at 6 o'clock also. Wednesdays, of course, me, Hank Jones. Thursdays, Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report, also 6 o'clock Eastern Time. And then Fridays at noon, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. Saturday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. And then Sundays, Eric's back with the Real Interfaith Dialogue as part of his Cross and Crescent discussion. Every day, 7 days a week. 7 shows. Great stuff. If you want to contact me off show, of course, hjsports1980@gmail.com. That's my current email. If I ever get an actual website domain, I'll make something simple. Go to Twitter, @hpolysports. Hit me up there. Go to Facebook, Hank Jones Polysports. You can do that as well. Come in through the chat room or online. You don't have to log into chat to actually listen, but it helps, especially if you want to actually partake in chat with others. Indie Hawk is in there right now. Or you can get in on the phones where there are a couple listeners right now. That number is 319-527-6706. If you have something to say, response, or want to talk about something, hit the 1 on your phone and I get those little icon. I will have a caller later on, and so probably the second half or last third of the show, it'll won't take calls unless he, you know, unless I see something that he wants to or something. My wife and little Aussie are in the house. We are here at Electric Hankland. And it's kind of a dreary day where we live, kind of overcast all day, raining, not cold, but not hot either. That's for darn sure. Let's get to the obituaries. Last Wednesday, we lost golfer Bob Golby at the age of 92. Bob Golby won 11 tournaments on the tour between 1958 and 1971. The most notable 1968 Masters at the renowned Augusta National. It wasn't that he won at Augusta, but rather how he won. He should have been in an 18-hole playoff with Roberto DiVincenzo. But unfortunately, Roberto DiVincenzo's playing partner, Tommy Aaron, had marked him for a par 4 on the 17th hole in the final round when he actually scored a birdie 3. By virtue of signing a scorecard, thus you're attesting to the veracity, the accuracy. By signing the incorrect scorecard, he pushed himself out of the playoffs. His iconic response was, "What a stupid I am, poor guy." Ironically, Bob Golby and Roberto DiVincenzo teamed up several years later on the Champions Tour. Not ruin a friendship or anything like that. It wasn't Bob Golby's fault. Bob Golby grew up in Belleville, Illinois. That's outside of St. Louis, Missouri. He was an all-state quarterback at Belleville West. He went on to the University of Illinois on a football scholarship, but was ruled ineligible for having played several baseball games for Southern Illinois the previous summer. He left college altogether. Then he ended up serving in the Korean War and then joined the PGA Tour in 1952. His nephew, by the way, is Jay Haas, a 9-time winner on the tour, and his great-nephew is Bill Haas, also on the tour, has won the Tour Championship and the FedEx Cup. Jay Haas has, I believe, 9 tour wins, if I remember correctly. Bob Golby passed away in his native Belleville, Illinois, last Wednesday. Nice little career and a really good guy. This next one's kind of tough. Last Thursday, we lost singer and actor Meat Loaf, born Marvin Lee Adey, at age 74. No definitive cause has been given, although it has been circulated that he had COVID, at least at some point. He's noted for several hits. His first one was 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad, off the album Bad Out of Hell. He did 3 Bad Out of Hell albums, the Bad Out of Hell, then Back Into Hell, I think it was called, and the third one I forgot. His most famous, probably Paradise by the Dashboard Light, or I'd Do Anything for Love, but I won't do that. Paradise by the Dashboard Light is best remembered for that video featuring Carla DeVito, a.k.a. Mrs. Robbie Benson. Although it was actually sung by Ellen Foley. I don't know how many times over the years I've had to tell people that. It was sung by Ellen Foley. She went on, she was the first season of Night Court. She was the public defender before she was replaced by Marky Post. But yeah, Ellen Foley was the actual recording voice on that song. Carla DeVito did tour in support of the album. Came the female voice behind Meat Loaf, but no, not the original singer on that song. As an actor, he appeared in both the Rocky Horror Show on stage and in the screen version, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, as well as the films Roadie, Out of Bounds, Wayne's World, Leap of Faith, Spice World, Fight Club, and Beautiful Boy. He supported Republican candidates for the most part, although he was not registered with any party. He believed climate change to be a hoax, said he felt sorry for Greta Thunberg due to her being brainwashed and exploited. Yeah, I agree, totally. Although some news outlets are citing the cause as COVID, he was against the continued shutdown of the country. He was against the vax mandates, the mask mandates. He had said in a recent interview, if he dies, he dies, but he will not be controlled by the politicization of COVID. So a sad loss, Marvin Lee Adey, a.k.a. Meat Loaf, at the age of 74. Friday, we had 3 notable. You can remember, this is notable to me. 3, though. Retired NHL Hall of Famer, Clark Gillies, 4-time Stanley Cup champion with the Islanders from 1980 to 83. He was the team captain in 77 to 79 as well. He was their first pick in the 1974 draft, and he was the 4th overall pick that year. He finished his career playing a season and a half with the Buffalo Sabres. Then he passed away last Friday at age 67 from cancer. We also lost James Forbes to complications of COVID at age 69. James Forbes, no relation to Malcolm Forbes, not part of the Forbes fortune. He was a member of the ill-fated 1972 U.S. Men's Olympic basketball team. Remember, they were robbed of a gold medal at the Munich Olympic Games? In fact, that team refused to accept the silver medals that they were awarded. Remember, the officials replayed the last 3 seconds of the game two different times after the original time. On the third time, they made U.S. player Tom McMillan stand back away from the Soviet on the inbounds pass. They had earlier ignored two flagrant fouls committed against two of the top U.S. players, Dwight Jones and Jim Brewer. I think Dwight Jones was ejected from the game, and Jim Brewer left. He was literally assaulted by Alexander Beloff. On the third version of the final play, Beloff pushed off on James Forbes, and then caught the long pass and scored the basket. The replay was ordered by Great Britain's Renato William Jones. He was the head of FIBA at the time. That's the governing body for international basketball competition. Forbes, though, along with his teammates, voted multiple times not to accept the silver medals. Then finally, Friday, we lost lovable comedian Louis Anderson. He was 68, passed from lymphoma. He was a veteran of the stand-up comedy circuit, as well as appeared in various TV and movie roles. Very lovable guy, no doubt. Well-respected by colleagues. I know Dennis Miller wrote, he said he was one of the very few that, no matter what, I always left my dressing room. Whether I went before him or after him on a bill, I always left my dressing room to go hear him. Saturday, we lost Hall of Fame guitarist Don Wilson of the Ventures at age 88. You know the Ventures, Walk, Don't Run. No, I didn't record it for this because it's not my favorite. I mean, it's an okay song, but that song, he was the guitarist on that song. We also lost, I don't know if this is a loss, Philadelphia mobster Ralph Natale at age 86. He was the first sitting boss who actually turned government witness while boss. Now, look, he was basically a puppet for Skinny Joey Merlino and his leadership group. Side note, some friends and I were in Boca Raton for a Kiwanis convention about 8 or 9 years ago. We almost ended up going to Merlino's restaurant where Skinny Joey is, wink, wink, just a host, not the owner. Natale, unlike the front bosses in the Genovese family or the Chicago outfit, he never figured out that he was pushed into the position intentionally and without his knowledge in order to keep the heat off the real brains, which was underboss Joey Merlino. Anyway, Ralph Natale gone at 86. And we bounce to yesterday. This one hurt my heart to see, and it hurts just as much to read it. You heard me doing my little spiel in the beginning of the beginning song. Yesterday we lost Peter Robbins to suicide at age 65. Actually, it was announced yesterday. If the name sounds familiar, it should. Peter Robbins was the original voice of Charlie Brown in the initial Peanuts TV specials and movie, A Boy Named Charlie Brown. He retired from the entertainment industry in 1972. Although he did do some stints in radio. Mostly, though, he was involved in real estate. His final role was in an episode of My Three Sons. Had some legal issues later in life, as well as some drug and alcohol problems. At his last round of legal proceedings, he noted that he suffered from bipolar disorder and paranoid schizophrenia. He was sentenced to 4 years and 8 months in December of 2015 for sending threatening letters to the manager and wife of a mobile home park where he lived. A plea deal is part of his earlier troubles. Now, he served much of his sentence at the California Institution for Men due to his mental state, and he was released in December of 2019. His family told Fox 5 in San Diego that Peter Robbins committed suicide last week at age 65. It was confirmed by a longtime friend at the station who had known him for over 25 years. This is a tough one to swallow for me. You heard me do the Charlie Brown teacher sound on that beginning song, Everybody's Talking. I've always loved the specials and the comic strip, the music. And he was the true voice of Charlie Brown, despite more or less aging out of the role. He wasn't in it after, I think, A Boy Named Charlie Brown, or maybe there was one other. But he was the true voice of Charlie Brown. Ironically, his that scream continued to actually be used for scenes like Lucy pulling the football when he tried to kick it. Even after fake Charlie Brown actors were brought in, they used his Og scream. I don't know, it just seems so sad for a guy who America loved to actually have these problems as an adult and to have it lead to his death. I mean, ironically, he played a quasi-depressed kid, I guess you could say. Always all bummed out and going to Lucy for help. Maybe that's part of the problem, but just very sad. It really hurt me to see that. I just feel bad. I mean, I'm feeling bad for Charlie Brown, not Peter Robbins maybe, but just, I don't know. Just go kick that football in heaven, Charlie Brown, that's for sure. Sports news. Major League Baseball Hall of Fame just concluded its voting for this year's class. Exactly one person got voted in, David Big Poppy Ortiz, formerly of the Red Sox. Not making it, Sammy Sosa, who was never really close. Barry Bonds, who reached over 66% at one point toward the required 75%. And Roger Clemens, who reached 65%. Kurt Schilling didn't make it either. He was actually at one point over 70%. And those four are now relegated to the next level, which is the Today's Game Committee. Only two other people, former Philly shortstop Jimmy Rollins and Yankee infielder Alex Rodriguez, gained enough support to be able to be placed on future ballots. Of those not making it, Bonds and Clemens, they had enough negative publicity from, performance-enhancing drugs to explain it. In the case of Sosa, he and Mark McGwire, they were part of that home run record chase in 1998. In 2001, he became the first player to hit 60 home runs in a season three times. But also, he had the corked bat controversy, and then also, like McGwire, they didn't look or sound very convincing when they were in front of Congress testifying about performance-enhancing drug use in sports. The fact they came off, slightly better than Rafael Palmeiro doesn't really count much for Hall of Fame voters. So, yeah, like McGwire, Sammy Sosa relies on some sort of veteran vote-in deal if he gets it at all. Ortiz was on his first ballot. He's the second designated hitter after Seattle Mariner Edgar Martinez. We're going to discuss more of this in the polysports segment later on, specifically the case of Kurt Schilling, because it's truly political. And a bit of sad news, college basketball color guy Dick Vitale is shutting it down for the season. Although he says he'll be back for 2022-23, he says a strain on his voice and throat after undergoing cancer treatments late last year was just too much, and he will be having vocal cord surgery in the coming months. Yeah, let's hope this is truly temporary. Yes, I get it. He's an ACC/Duke/Coach K fanboy. He didn't earn that Dukey V nickname on a whim, but he's great for the game. His enthusiasm's genuine. His knowledge is still there. And, yeah, while he favors the ACC a lot, he does give props to other conferences and players from those conferences. He's not like Paul Feinbaum is to SEC football. Paul Feinbaum is just a tool. But, no, Dick Vitale's a good guy. He gives props to other conferences and players, as I said. He's today's version of Al McGwire, really, who, in my opinion, just my humble opinion, is the best all-time basketball. So get well. Be back, Coach Vitale. Also in college basketball, Auburn this week is ranked number one in the AP poll for the first time in history. Now, Gonzaga's back to number one in the coaches poll, but Auburn, yeah, number one with Bruce Pearl. So, yeah, how legit. In celebration, Auburn's barely squeaked by Missouri last night in its first game as number one. Elsewhere, the top 25, number 7 UCLA had a pretty convincing win over number 3 Arizona, won by 16. The only top 25 loss this last couple of days was Michigan State, number 10. They fell by a single point at number 24, Illinois. Kind of ironic. The Illini were without two of their starters, including All-American center Kofi Coburn. One game features two top 25 teams playing tonight. Number 17, Providence, is heading to number 21, Xavier. Big Ten has a pretty full slate this week, including tomorrow night, number 6, Purdue, heads to Iowa City to take on my Iowa Hawkeyes. Looking forward to it, for sure. That's the 9 p.m. game on Fox Sports 1. Then next Monday, the Hawks head back to Happy Valley, take on the Nittany Lions. Remember, they beat them by 17 last Saturday. So, 17. Transfer portal. Has anyone taken a look at this thing lately? As of the end of December, there were over 900 entries. At that time, 243 had either found a home or, in the case of 32 of them, withdrew their names. Recently, one or two Alabama guys did the same thing, withdrew their names. Now, that meant at the time there were almost 650 players still in the portal, almost 75%. While that sounds high, consider that there are over 11,000 FBS scholarships out there. Still, 75% had yet to find a new home. Now consider this, and this is what I'm getting at. The very second a guy puts his name in the portal, the school or coach can stop all team involvement with him. They don't have to, and in some cases, players even agree to stay for a bowl game or for emergency status. As example, although this was pre-portal, in 2017, Tyler Wiegers had already told Kirk Ferentz and the Iowa Hawkeye staff that he was leaving. But he agreed to stay through the bowl game because of, you know, to be a backup for Nate Stanley in case of an injury or whatever. He agreed to stay. Others leave immediately. The schools must honor the academic side. Player can stay to finish the semester. The coach can remove him from the roster, can stop access to team meals, workout facilities, anything else team-related. Like I said, any academic-related access, including tuition, books, classes, even tutoring. But here's the thing. If a guy burns bridges and then doesn't get any interest, he's done. I mean, no more scholarly at that school, no more access, short of course, groveling to get back on the team. And, of course, we've seen scenarios where a guy's in the portal and stays at the school. Two cases at Iowa, Davion Nixon and Caleb Shudak. Caleb Shudak was our kicker this year, as a matter of fact. Davion Nixon played a couple seasons before leaving early for the NFL. But, like I said, other guys have entered the portal and not found a new home or found no playing time or on-field success at the next stop. Now, consider further. Oliver Martin went from Michigan to Iowa to Nebraska. And there are other guys that have jumped around just as much. So, yeah, maybe several things need to be reviewed. Yeah, I get it. Guys burn bridges all the time. Yes, coaches and staffs miss out on player evaluation all the time. Yeah, some guys just aren't happy no matter where they are, who they're with, what coach is in place. I get all that. But, man, I'm thinking we're seeing something really ironic here. Like, on the one hand, players have free movement. Coaches already had that. But now, I mean, we see guys jumping into the portal on a whim. Coaches are taking players with them now to new schools. I don't think that was ever intended. But in the worst cases, like I said, players find no new home and they're left out in the cold. I just think we need some kind of a happy medium. Along that line, the NCAA released a draft of their new streamlined constitution. Good God. It was originally 43 pages. They got it down to 18 and a half pages. The chair of the committee doing it, Shane Lyons from West Virginia, the athletic director of West Virginia. Here's his statement. This constitution is not for today and tomorrow. It's for 10 years from now, 20 years from now. What's potentially the association going to look like? Now, it talks about more broad goals of athlete welfare and athletics as part of an academic experience, instead of governing procedures and operation, both of which have come under increasing criticism. Yeah, no kidding. It's not the system that's been the problem. It's been the implementation of the system. I mean, Notre Dame never really getting any punishment. And of course, Miami a couple of years ago, where they compromised the investigation by whining and dining the investigator. And then, of course, UNC, when they reasoned that, yeah, the athletes were taking courses that weren't really part of a curriculum. They were taking fake courses. But non-athletes were allowed to take them, too. That doesn't make it, I mean, unbelievable. And that's, yeah, at that point, the NCAA had no teeth. Like somebody said, when a North Carolina transgresses, Middle Tennessee State better be prepared to pay. So when they say that they're going to membership for feedback and they're going to their constitutional convention and trying to streamline it, look, that's not really what I'm not sure it'll make any difference. Look, like much of professional sports, the NCAA is becoming more political by the day. And with that letter last week, for example, from Nick Saban and others, it's not slowing down any. I think Outkick.com's Jason Whitlock said it best, though, especially with regard to that letter. He put it this way. Nick Saban probably isn't really a Democrat. He just thinks he needs to talk like one in today's recruiting landscape. So, yeah, what is the NCAA looking for here? I mean, is this a matter of member schools wanting more control? The NCAA palace dwellers like Mark Emmert and his $3 million a year, knowing that the gig is up, so they may as well try and preserve whatever relevance they can. I don't know. I mean, honestly, is it just a stopgap before Congress swoops in? Look, I know I've been in the chat room on Tim Tapp's show. Tim is another host on blogtalkradio.com. It's called Tap Into the Truth. Great guy, great host. Tim's contention is that liberals just don't like sports, and that's why they're trying to destroy the landscape. I disagree. I think they see the money, and they want at it. I mean, what is Big Left better at than just about anybody? That's right, laying claim to money that isn't theirs, isn't rightfully theirs. How do they do that? Several ways. One, they regulate, or they threaten to regulate. Nothing scares a business or an industry more than the idea of a watchdog. Especially when it's constructed by and comprised of people who know nothing about the subject they want to regulate. But because the business or industry sector themselves and the money seekers, they often go along in what they think will be a limited fashion. Number two, they investigate and then litigate, especially if they can't regulate. Now, they do this under the guise of, quote, need for oversight. If the control-seeking money grabbers can't get an industry to agree to regulation, by God, just investigate and litigate. I mean, they go around, that's what the DOJ is for. They trumpet that crap. In their minds, that's what it is. They've taken down numerous industries over the years. They use terms like antitrust or corruption or restraint. Don't buy it. What they want is the money. And the third way, they demonize. They basically use big media and industry flunkies, think savings and loan, way back when in late 80s, early 90s. They used failed savings and loan execs to come out and tell us what was wrong with the savings and loan industry. Yeah, so they use those guys and big media. They promote the idea that these industries or organizations are evil, that they get rich illegally, or they do it by screwing we the people. One particular phrase, one which absolutely disgusts me to no end, is this one. We cannot sit by and let Company A or Industry X get rich off the backs of the poor. Yeah, they strawman the hell out of the idea that the only way to build revenue or wealth or success is by someone else not building revenue or wealth or success. I'm going to have Hawkeye Mike on later to talk about Justice Breyer, but in a liberal's mind, it's impossible for someone like Hawkeye Mike to go to law school unless someone else, quote-unquote, fails or is victimized. To the liberal mind, it's impossible for a coach to succeed unless he has taken advantage of player one, two, or three. I mean, there are several theories behind this sickness, but the basic fact in this twisted thinking is that, quote, success can only come via someone else's failure. But rather than leave it at that, they demonize those who reap success. Rather than allow the possibility that some people are lazy or idiotic or moronic or just unlucky, they take the entirety of the unsuccessful and collectively blame the successful. Now, like thus, when you see a Cory Booker blaming, quote, the system for justification to pay players, you're told that the system's bad. You aren't told that Cory Booker himself was never poor. You're never told that he didn't actually need a football scholarship in order to go to college, but rather you're told that he was a player and he sees the inherent evil in the system. Jeez, damn if that didn't jump from polysports in a hurry, huh? Moving on, next week, the 2022 Winter Olympics open in Beijing. The U.S. is sending its athletes, but not its diplomats. U.S. Olympic and governmental leadership, of course, they're clueless. This is the way it should always be. They act like that we're missing something with them not being there. Not a thing. Nevertheless, we get to see a U.S. ski team that's missing a couple of injured skiers, while at the same time we'll see some of our best. Sean White will go for another couple medals on his snowboard. By the way, is this dude starting to look old? Huh? He does. I saw him the other day. There was like a commercial. It's like, dang, he's looking like he could be almost 40 or something. I mean, for snowboarding, I mean, I know I'm older than that. My wife's looking at me. But the point is, for us snowboarders are like 19. This dude looks 40, as she said, look in the mirror lately. I know how old I am. This dude's starting to look old. Well, of course it's his last Olympics. Next Olympics, he'll be dead. Well, maybe not. Here's the pre-Olympic official Olympic legitimacy and watch guide, courtesy of Hank Jones Polysports. Suffice it to say, you should refer to this guide whenever you question whether or not you should flip on the games on your cable box or streaming stick. Or for that matter, whether you should bother jimmying with the rabbit ears. So here goes. Number one, if it's a race, it's legit, and therefore it's worth watching. Now, whether it's that cross-country moguls event where they knock each other down or the biathlon, you can see who wins without some old goat from Great Britain or France prattling on about what made it good or great. The winner was, key word here, in those events, the winner was chosen. In other words, if the winner is determined by 8 people from the European Union, or worse, includes people like some vodka-slugging dude from a country whose name ends with Ekistan or Avia or Enia or Enia, that's a hard pass. The winner of that event is only the winner of a popularity contest. This does not apply to women's figure skating. Assuming all participants are actual women, that winner is simply determined by the shortest skirt or best legs. I mean, that's, I don't know, but that's... Now, if it's a game where points are scored and the winner is the one who actually scores the most points, yes, it's legit. Now, this includes hockey, of course. If you're going to only watch one Olympic Winter Olympic event, it should be hockey. Now, curling is gaining popularity, and theoretically, you can do it with a beer in your hand. But it's way slower than hockey, and physical fitness or lack thereof isn't really even critical. So it's more of a hobby or a fun activity than it is an actual sport. But for something to do at 3 a.m. when you can't sleep and it's the only event all that's on and you've watched all episodes of Ozark or Mad Men or whatever, curling will do. I mean, if it's the only event being shown, what the heck? Now, skiing is awesome, whether it's alpine or cross-country or ski jumping. But when you combine it with shooting, like in the biathlon, it takes on a special quality. Well, anyone can learn to ski fast or train to ski long distances, but to do it with the added time off the trail for some good old-fashioned target shooting, yeah, that's a solid entry in the win column as far as I'm concerned. Now, but look, bobsled, luge, and skeleton, they all work. The requisite gruesome crash never hurts for added entertainment, as long as it's not like an American team or individual. Ski jumping, 4 words. What's not to like? Yeah, that's basically your Olympic viewing guide, your Winter Olympic viewing guide from Hank Jones Polysports. Finally, in sports, we have the NFL playoffs. I've got to say, last weekend was as good as it gets for NFL viewing. All four games were one-score contests. 3 of the 4 We're won by the lower seed, which means the visiting team. First three games were won on field goals as time expired. I mean, that's pretty solid. Eddie Hawk asks a question. I should have been looking a little more closely. Who's going to be the first guy to play for four different teams in college? Well, let's quickly Google that. Has a college ball player played for four or more teams? Not seeing it. Not seeing it. No. No, that's just not seeing it, Andy. Sorry. It'll be interesting when it happens, though. That's for sure. So, yeah, but okay. So the first three games were won as time expired with field goals. Literally, field goals kicked on the final play of the game. That's pros. Mrs. Hank pointed out Vinny Testaverde, seven teams, but that's in the pros. We're talking college, 4 years, four teams. She doesn't listen to my show, but she interrupts this news bulletin. The fourth game, the Kansas City Chiefs forced overtime. Now, Buffalo Bills scored a touchdown, and Kansas City Chiefs had 13 seconds to go down and tie the game, which they did. So they forced overtime on a field goal as time expired. Unfortunately, the NFL's overtime rule absolutely penalized the Buffalo Bills, which didn't necessarily lose to a better team, but rather lost to a damn coin toss. I mean, how stupid is that? I mean, can we not get these leagues, whether it's the NCAA, the NFL, the bowl games or whatever, to come up with better overtime rules? I mean, the college game scales down as overtime progresses. Which, that's fine. I mean, you know, after a certain point, you have to go for two. And then after a certain point, then every play is just a two-point conversion play. That's fine. But they don't use kickoffs or punts. Special teams is out of the equation. And believe it or not, some teams stress special teams preparation as much as they do offensive preparation and defensive preparation. In other words, complete teams. As Andy Hawk points out, especially in the playoffs. The NFL rule, sudden death overtime, is just wrong, especially in the playoffs. I get it if you go to like a third overtime. But for a first overtime, now they changed it. Remember, it used to be just a field goal would do it. They changed it so that if you got a field goal, then the other team got a chance to tie it and or win it. Like you could tie it with a field goal or win it with a touchdown. But they didn't make it any better when they did that, in a sense. It still penalizes a team potentially for losing a coin toss. Look, I'm not saying the Chiefs didn't deserve to win. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying the Bills didn't deserve to lose simply because they lost a coin toss. That's just absolutely absurd. So, this weekend we get the conference championship games. Sunday, the 3 p.m. game, the Cincinnati Bengals head to Kansas City, take on the Chiefs, the aforementioned Chiefs. Right now the line is Kansas City 7 points, over-under is 54.5 points. The 6:30 game, San Francisco 49ers head to L.A. to take on the Rams. Rams are a 3.5-point favorite. Over-under on that is 46 points. I am sorry. I just have no – I wish I could say, well, I'm seeing this happening. I just don't know. Last few years, the 49ers were no big bargain as a team, and suddenly here they are in the NFC Championship game, the Buffalo Bills in the NFC Championship game. Now we're seeing several Hawkeyes in the NFC and AFC championship games. Okay, here's a question. This was brought up because I'm going to talk about it a little bit in the politics part, but there are 29 Democrats retiring in the House. T. Bodie points out in 2020 there were 51 open seats in the cycle, but not sure of the party line. So, and that's not, you know, that's between House and Senate. I thought it was between House and Senate. Anyway, so Indy Hawk saw a guy playing for his third school. Well, we've already seen it with Oliver Martin. So, but anyway, so as far as this weekend, it's so tough. I mean, you've got the NFL game is different. You kind of know in college. I mean, yeah, the Alabama-Georgia game was kind of, well, I don't know. It could go either way. But in the pros, there's just so much can happen. And frankly, you know, the Chiefs coming back, getting that game-tying field goal with 13 seconds left. I mean, you don't even really see that in college football. You see it with some teams. But for the most part, it's just not an occurrence in college football. My wife is looking at me really weird, and I don't know what. Oh. I would say the Alabama Crimson Tide. Mrs. Hank asked which team produces the most NFL players. I said the Alabama Crimson Tide. Of course. That's for this year. My God, she just said go Bama. See what I put up with, people? Anyway. If you were to ask me which teams I'm picking, I have absolutely. I mean, it's mystifying me because nothing will surprise me, especially after the first couple. I mean, who saw the Packers and the Titans losing, and frankly, the Buccaneers? Who saw the Buccaneers losing? A lot of people saw them as being the next Super Bowl champ. You know, or repeating a Super Bowl champ, I should say, not next, repeating a Super Bowl champ. So, who knows? If I have to pick, I'm going to go with Chiefs and the 49ers. 49ers have the George Kittle factor, we'll call it, and the Chiefs have the Patrick Mahomes factor. I mean, again, 13 seconds, driving the team down to get the tying field goal, pretty outstanding. But again, like I said, the overtime rule, absolutely penalized the Buffalo Bills. T. Bodie says there was 40 seats in 2020. Oh. T. Bodie usually comes with good stuff, but he screwed me out of 11 seats on that one. So anyway, okay, you know what? We're done with sports. I'm going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and get into some politics, including a discussion with Hawkeye Mike being our local legal expert who is going to get into the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer. But in the meantime, I didn't download any Meatloaf music. I didn't download Charlie Brown music. I could play Charlie Brown, Great Pumpkin, but I'm not going to. But we're going to play what do we want to play? Got to be short. Ah, here we go. Since I was talking about it with sports, about the money. We'll be right back. About 2 minutes.
Stop wasting my time. You know what I want. You know what I need. Oh, maybe you don't. Do I have to come right flat out and tell you everything? Give me some money. getting me right.
Money.
Your face is okay, but your purse is too tight.
Money.
I'm looking for a pound, no blue chain, fat checks, anything.
Give me some money.
And we are back. You are listening to Hank Jones Polysports here on Global Patriot Radio at blogtalkradio.com. I am Hank Jones, your host for Wednesday, January 26th, 2022. That was Give Me Some Money by Spinal Tap. Yeah, that's, you know, give me some money. That's what they want out of sports. That's what Big Left wants from our sports teams. So we're going to get into a bit of politics, and then we'll bring on Hawkeye Mike for our discussion about the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer. By the way, the first nomination is in from Indy Hawk KB, who nominates Hawkeye Mike. I'm not sure if Indy Hawk – Indy, forward that to your congressperson or your senator and see how that goes. There are now, as I mentioned, 29 House or Senate Democrats. I'm not sure if that's both or it's just in the House. But they are not running for re-election in November. While that's all well and good, by the way, it doesn't mean a Republican or a conservative will take the seat. So, yeah, if a Republican gets it, it doesn't mean he or she isn't a rhino or somebody simply wanting to avoid a Democrat primary, so they run as a Republican. Still, it's a good sign a lot of them are stepping down. Now, temper that with this. Nancy Pelosi is now running for re-election. Now, should the GOP take the House, she will almost certainly not be elected as House Speaker. But if you remember the last time the GOP took back the House, she wasted a ton of time campaigning for the Speaker position. It effectively left the GOP dealing with both finding a suitable Speaker candidate and having to listen to her blather on. Yeah, but it's not likely that she would lose a re-election race. So the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine is urging American citizens to leave Ukraine ASAP. The U.S. has also committed 8,500 military personnel to the country. This, of course, is a response to the almost certain movement by Russia to invade and take over. And with that, this is the sick part. And with that, we actually have Democrats making statements, public statements, mind you, on the importance of sovereignty and borders. No, not our borders, Ukraine's borders. You literally cannot make this stuff up. You can't. Even if you did LSD or opium or whatever, like Samuel Taylor Coleridge when he wrote Kubla Khan, remember? He was interrupted, and so he wasn't able to finish it, but he was on a roll. No, there is no drug or drink that could enable you to write this scenario. Where the majority party in Congress and the White House ignore our borders, but go to great lengths to preserve borders and sovereignty for a country half a world away. The New York State Supreme Court struck down the mask mandate that was initially instituted by disgraced former Governor Andrew Cuomo and continued by his successor, Kathy Hochul. Justice Thomas Rademacher did write that he was not taking sides in the debate, merely that mask mandates were not within the purview of the office of the governor. So B. Joe got caught on a hot mic calling Fox News' Peter Ducey a stupid son of a bitch after a question from Ducey about Bidenflation. Big media, of course, really the whole of Big Left, has circled the wagons. One CNN hack said Dopey actually called Ducey to apologize, then actually corrected it to say Dopey Joe called to say it's nothing personal, since no apology was needed. One brainless liberal on Twitter, okay, I get it, that's redundant, said she was, quote, okay with what he said, and added, and I really respect that he made the phone call. I had to point this out to this moronette, that if she's okay with what Dopey Joe said, why is she applauding a phone call? If she was okay with it, there was nothing right or honorable about the phone call. Yeah, I'm still waiting to hear back on that one. Yeah, now, can you imagine if President Trump had done this? Can you imagine I mean, it's mind-boggling how they've circled the wagons. Now, actress Cheryl Hines, a.k.a. Mrs. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., she spoke out against her husband's statements on vaccines and comparing mandatory vaccines to the plight of Nazi victims. Somehow Anne Frank got brought into it. I'm sure he didn't, but somebody did. Remember, Anne Frank was taken to Bergen-Belsen concentration camp by the Nazi regime, died at the age of 15. RFK, of course, walked it back. Naturally, he's a lib and he's a Kennedy still. But he's been pretty anti-vax, not just recently, but before that. Anyway, his wife said they have differing opinions, and although she wasn't outspoken or critical of him directly, she did agree with some Twitter posts that said he was wrong and way off base. They apparently got into a row back during the holidays, too, when she required visitors to be vaxxed, and he said that he didn't want that. But then he later admitted he's not in charge of the household. And then in follow the science news, the FDA has revoked emergency use authorization for monoclonal antibodies for COVID treatment. This affects Florida more than most because Governor Ron DeSantis has gotten the treatment centers out there. He's been a big proponent of it, established many centers across the state. And here's part of the story because he says a couple interesting things. You got to love Governor DeSantis. He basically is pretty hacked off. He made a thing. He said, look, without a shred of clinical data to support this action, President Biden has forced trained medical professionals to turn away people and choose between treating their patients or breaking the law. He says there are real-world implications to this medical authoritarianism. And Americans' access to treatments is now subject to the whims of a failing president. Finished with, this is not how you help people. The government has gone above and beyond to deny access. And now they're told it would be illegal for a provider to give it to them. Holger, who is called in on this show and calls in on Vito's show, and now is doing, by the way, his own show again. Look for it. I'll tell you about it when I know it's coming up. He made a good point. He said, have you noticed, whether it's ivermectin or any of the other, every time they withdraw a treatment, they don't come up with a new one, come up with a new treatment. All they do is just get rid of one treatment, something that could be successful. And T. Bodie brought up, so he emailed me something the other day about, it was last week actually, about some stuff that's going on with Pfizer and some of these others. And I can't read them out. I don't want to read them out. But basically, what's happening are literally, I mean, Pfizer's talking about annual vaccines. Pfizer's talking about, oh, treatments this, treatments that. But they don't want cures, obviously. And what's the point of a single vaccine when they can make you get vaccinated every year? And yet they're pulling these treatments and they're totally ignoring the fact that these vaccines have caused some real issues. Now, remember I had my buddy Rich on last year who was at January 6th, but he's also a medical provider, and he's talked about, you know, it's hard to find, but it is findable if you know where to look. The adverse reactions to the vaccine. Now, look, I'm vaccinated. Full disclosure, I am vaccinated. Hawkeye Mike's coming on in a second. He's vaccinated, got the booster, et cetera. Personal choice. But when you're mandating vaccines, be it for healthcare providers or private employers, which have been shot down at least, and then you're pulling treatments off, but you notice, where was it in biggest use? It was biggest used in Florida, and he pulls it. I mean, first of all, the FDA and the CDC, you would think that those two agencies talk a bit. You would think normally, under normal circumstances. Now, I've seen no evidence that those two agencies work together in any way. It's really, really, I mean, just... But yeah, follow the science, right? Follow the science. pretty kind of perturbing. This next subject, I'm only going to say, it's just two words. It's not really even a subject. We're not going to discuss it. I'm just going to say it.
Neil Young.
That's it. Just that.
Neil Young.
Okay, we're going to talk about it quickly. I used to like Neil Young, some of his songs. I still do. If you're going to go off on vaccines and condemn Spotify or condemn Joe Rogan, here's an idea. Don't look like the damn poster child for why we shouldn't get into drug use. Poster child for COVID. I mean, good Lord. If you're going to get out there, at least look. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, it's sort of like Otis Campbell from Mayberry extolling the virtues of wearing a tux everywhere. I mean, it's just not. I mean, what is he saying? Just, I don't get it. I mean, you either have me or have Joe Rogan. Yeah, get educated here, Neil. I'm pretty sure Spotify is going to choose Joe Rogan. 11 million listeners a day at one point. You haven't done anything relevant since the 1990s. So, yeah. Okay, finally, we've come to the news that Stephen Breyer, the oldest justice of the Supreme Court, is retiring at the end of the current session, which I believe ends in June. I'm going to bring in Hawkeye Mike now, go over a few things and some possible scenarios. Mike, how's it going?
Going well, Hank. How you doing?
Pretty good. Did this news shock you?
No, not at all. It did and it didn't. I think, you know, there was a speculation at the end of the term last year that he was going to step down and he didn't do it. And a lot of people on the left were not very happy about that.
Right.
And so I kind of thought that he would step down at the end of this term, which actually doesn't end until June. What surprised me was that it came out now in January that he was going to do that. Normally what happens is they wait till toward the end of the term. And the last opinions are released. And then, you know, in that period, they would announce that they're stepping down. And then you'd have the summer to confirm a new appointee for the next term, which starts in October. So I think there's been some reports that he was not happy with the news being released today. And that tells me that this was likely a leak. And it's customary when a justice is going to retire that obviously before it's publicly announced, he notifies the White House in particular so they're prepared. And my guess is that that may have been what happened and that somebody at the White House leaked the story. And apparently, from what I'm hearing anyway, Justice Breyer wasn't too pleased about it. So, but no, I'm not surprised. He's retiring. I'm surprised that it came out today.
Yeah. He was the one that they wanted him to retire before, correct? He was the one they wanted to.
Well, he's 83 years old. And, yeah. I mean, look, I think they can see that there's some of the writing on the wall. Administration, Democratic Party, that they're probably not going to have a good November. It could be very problematic to get him anybody confirmed after this year.
Right. Okay. Is he considered? I mean, in your opinion, as an attorney, not practicing, I understand, but as an attorney, is he considered a
recovering
good? Oh yeah, recovering. Is he considered a good legal mind by the legal establishment, if you will?
Think he is. There's never been that I know of any real challenge about his ability or his legal acumen. He's highly thought of and was considered for many years the sort of the liberal sort of intellectual counter to Justice Scalia, from what I can tell.
Okay.
I don't think he's quite in that league with Justice Scalia, but of course, you know, I'm probably not completely, you know,
objective
here.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. Yes, he's highly thought of. He's written many books. I think he's a great legal mind. And
okay.
He is obviously on the liberal side of the court, but I would say of the three liberals we have, the other two being Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, he is probably the least far to the left of those three.
Okay, so he's not as rad. Okay. Now, has he done any landmark cases before, either before or, you know, like when he was a judge before, like as a district judge or circuit judge or whatever, on any other federal judgeship? Or
yeah, I don't know too much about before he went on the court, and I'm not going to throw out specific cases, but he has been pretty much and written some opinions supporting abortion rights. Of course, he was on the 5-4 majority that struck down, or I mean that upheld the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
Right.
And more recently, cases that upheld or actually that struck down the Trump administration's efforts to ask certain questions in the census regarding citizenship. He was in a 5-4 majority. So he and the other liberals and Chief Justice Roberts have been formed, you know, particularly before the appointment of before the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett, that formed in a lot of cases a 5-4 majority in a lot of significant cases.
Yeah. Yeah, so he is. I mean, obviously, he is considered liberal. He was appointed by Bill Clinton. Has he written any of the landmark opinions? Like, has he been the lead opinion guy on any of this stuff?
Yeah, I don't. Off the top of my head, I can't remember specifically which ones, but he did. He was the author. I'm trying to remember now. A couple of abortion cases. I don't know if he did on the census case. So you got me a little bit stumped on that. I'd have to go back and look that up. I didn't get that.
Okay.
But yes, he's been prominent. He's also wrote some concurrences that were pretty stinging in, for instance, the recent case that struck down the vaccine mandate for through the OSHA regulations that was basically, mandating vaccines for nearly 100 million people in the private sector.
Yeah. So he was for that. He wasn't for the striking down. He's
been pretty deferential toward congressional determinations. He's considered a pretty good expert on administrative law and, of course, more on the side of upholding the administrative regulatory state, a lot of their decisions, such as with the OSHA, using the OSHA regulation to try to impose vaccine mandates on most of the country. And so I would say that he's been supportive of the big state, in most of his decisions. Yeah.
Okay. So take us through the process. I mean, does the process begin now? Can President Biden appoint someone now, or does he have to wait until he is actually off the court?
Well, my understanding is that he's not going to be stepping down until the end of the term. So there's technically, even if he announces his resignation, it's not going to be effective until the end of the term. If that's the case, and that's the reports that I've heard, there probably won't be a nominee announced until after his nomination becomes effective. Although I suppose they could announce somebody, and the confirmation hearings wouldn't start until after he stepped down. But my guess is that it's been an anticipation that he would resign. So there's probably been a lot of work done at the White House to pick out who they want. You'll hear a lot of names, and we can talk about a couple of them. One in particular, I think, is the most likely nominee. But again, I'm just
Yeah, well, give some names. What are some names?
Yeah, there's a I think the likeliest nominee, and I think I would say she may be an odds-on favorite, is a judge on the D.C. Circuit named Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Okay.
She's a U.S. district. She's been a U.S. district judge for a while, and she was elevated to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia last year. And I think that there seems to be consensus that she's very highly thought of and likely going to be picked. But I wouldn't bet the house on it. I think there's also been a mention. There's several other justices. One other justice that's been mentioned or judge that's been mentioned is a justice on the California Supreme Court, namely, I think her name is Leandra Kruger. Now, don't know a lot about her, but and by the way, the characteristic of these two is that they're African-American women, and of course, that's important because Biden has made a pledge that he would appoint the first African-American female to the Supreme Court. So I think there's anticipation that it's going to be someone like that. The fun speculation is whether, and I'm sure you might have an opinion on this, is whether he might appoint his vice president, the former attorney general of California,
meaning
which has a lot of political implications.
Kamala Harris. Now, is that being talked about, or is that your secular, or is that your dream?
It's being talked about, but I personally don't think that's going to happen for a couple of reasons. I think it would be actually controversial to some extent on the left, because it's going to look like he's, you know, trying to get rid of her as vice president and potential president. And there, if he did do that, there might be something to that. But I don't think that'll happen. I wouldn't rule it out. You know.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. Do you think it's a fait accompli that it is going to be a woman and it is going to be an African-American woman?
Well, you know, I mean, nothing 100%, but I would say it's guess it's 99%, 98% certain that he will keep to his promise to appoint the first African-American woman to the court. And so I do think, I think the odds-on favorite is this Ketanji Brown Jackson on the D.C. Circuit.
Yeah. Now, what would be the reason for a Kamala Harris? Strictly because the left is posturing or strategizing, and they don't think that she could, quote unquote, that she would be run out on a rail, so to speak, if President Biden doesn't finish out his term.
Right. Well, I think we can all speculate on if that was to happen, why. I think the speculation would be that because she's not perceived as necessarily the most popular vice president of all time, and because there's been some controversy about her and whether she's really up to the job of becoming president, if something were to happen to our current president, I think that there's a view that maybe, you know, if you could put her on the Supreme Court and get someone else as vice president, that might benefit the administration. I think the
short answer is it would be for political reasons.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think people under, I mean, people are talking about, she's our next, she'll, you know, Kamala Harris is our next president. And, you know, and people are forgetting, you know, if you impeach him, like you said, back during the initial election controversy, you know, if he becomes our president, by God, you better pray for his health, because the alternative is not good.
Well, you know, and I don't think if she's appointed to the Supreme Court because of her towering judicial intellect.
Okay, I mean, I don't think people understand either that, you know, they've got to hold on to Dopey Joe until next year. I mean, if it happens in, you know, October or whatever. And he's impeached, or they 25th Amendment, or whatever the case may be, the whoever takes his place, whether it's Kamala Harris or whoever, can only run for re-election once at that point. You know, they cannot serve more than 2 years of his term and be elected twice. I mean,
right.
It's,
right.
You know, and I think, you know, if I'm thinking that, then people on the left have to be thinking that. I mean, certainly Barack Obama, who I think is running things anyway, I think he's thinking that. But,
right.
You know,
well, I think there's a lot of nervousness if you get a lot of Democrats alone on the prospect of her succeeding him as president.
Yeah. And being electable. I just don't think she's electable.
And that,
you know,
too.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate.
So. Well, okay. Now let's talk this. This is kind of stupid. I mean, I know it's, in terms of if you were writing up a handbook for a president to pick the ideal Supreme Court justice, what are we really looking for? I mean, are we looking for someone that has definitely served on the federal bench? Is that necessarily important? I mean, you know, from what I understand, you don't even have to have been a judge to be a Supreme Court justice. And,
no, you don't, but I can't remember the last time that someone wasn't who was put on the Supreme Court. It's been a long time, and if you look at the three picks that Trump made when he was in office, and if you look at if you look at the three picks Trump made, they all came from the Court of Appeals, various circuits. Actually, Elena Kagan, I don't think, was on the bench when she's picked, but she'd had – had prominent appellate practice and had been Solicitor General of the United States.
Okay.
If Kamala Harris was to be picked, it would be the same thing. I don't think she's ever been on the bench, but she was Attorney General of California for many years.
I'm trying to remember who was the woman that George W. Bush, Harriet Myers.
His personal attorney. Well, that didn't go over very well, even among Republicans. There was really a perception there that she was really not qualified for the job, and it looked like a little bit of cronyism. And I think a lot of people there, you know, she had no, and from the point of view of the conservatives at the time, you know, there was no way to gauge, you know, really what her judicial philosophy was. Because there was no way to know it, and there was some feeling that might be a problem. But I think, by and large, there was a perception that among a lot of people that she was not really qualified to be on the Supreme Court.
Okay.
You know.
But I mean, is it better, do you think there's a certain mindset that one has to have? I mean, you think, as an example, if one was just a prosecutor, or should they have defense and prosecutorial experience both? I mean, do you think that's important?
Well, and a lot of them do before they become judges, you know, at the district court level, or they've spent a lot of time in private practice, or in government, prosecuting, defending, things like that. So they got it. They did get it that way, but. I think there's and that makes sense to me, as someone who worked as a law clerk and staff attorney in the federal courts for 16 years, to me that judges are with people with judicial backgrounds make the best Supreme Court justices, because what you do at the Supreme Court by and large is the same thing you're doing as a district court judge or as a judge on the Court of Appeals. In terms of applying federal law and the Constitution, and that's what you're going to do in the Supreme Court. It's just that the Supreme Court's the ultimate court, and what they say is it.
Yeah. So, but as far as you mentioned private practice. So, is private practice an essential too, or is it just if somebody who's just been a government lawyer all their life, is that really what? You know, I mean, I'm not sure if there's a better alternative.
That's a matter of opinion. I mean, obviously, when you talk about private practice, as someone that's done a lot of trial work, it's going to lend itself to being, qualifications for a judge. But a lot of them do come out of the government side or the prosecution side. And.
Yeah.
And, it's just a question, as far as like if you're picking someone to be a judge, especially initially, what kind of experience do you like the most? But, you know, I mean, I think that particularly to get to the federal bench, you've got to pretty much establish yourself as a pretty competent attorney.
Yeah.
You know, I won't say that there aren't some duds out there in the federal courts, but I think when you get to the state courts, you can get more uneven in terms of the quality of the judges. But at the federal level, you know, you really have to be up on your stuff.
Okay.
And it's just a higher level. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this, as T. Bodie pointed out in the chat room, this whoever he picks is not going to get the same scrutiny that we saw with Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett. You know, I mean, I can't believe that.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a good point, and I wanted to make that point, and that is this. I think what you'll see with whoever the nominee is, Kamala Harris, that the and there will be a significant number of Republicans that will not, I predict, support whoever Biden chooses. But the treatment that nominee will get is going to be a lot different than the treatment that we've seen in the recent past of Republican appointees. And I would point specifically to Clarence Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh. And you won't get the vitriol. You won't get the kind of dirt digging both among politicians on the of the other party or in the press that you'll see, that we've seen when a Republican's been appointed.
Yeah, I mean,
I would also predict, and you can take it for what it's worth, and whether it's a good thing or not, that there will probably, particularly if it's somebody like this Ketanji Brown Jackson, that you will see probably a few Republicans that will actually vote to confirm. And I'm thinking like Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, a few others. It's my understanding that, for instance, like Susan Collins, Republican senator from Maine, has voted for, since she's been in the Senate now 25 years or so, every Democratic appointee that's been made to the Supreme Court, she has voted to confirm.
Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising. I mean,
that's the way it is.
Yeah. I would imagine there are probably people within the Republican, you know, that don't see the point of fighting it. You know what I mean? That aren't going to, you know, some will, but I'm sure there are some who are otherwise conservatives and have a conservative voting record who just don't. It's just, that's one of the things, that's not a hill they're willing to die on, you know, within the press. And that's just, that's the other thing.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the other thing.
Well,
go
ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. A black female is nominated by the president. What battle do you win there? You know, I mean, I'm sorry. It's, like it or not, that's just not one.
The specter of racism will be raised.
I mean, you literally need to have film of that person, you know, rioting in Portland before you could even raise any kind of objection, you know, at least within the media. I mean, I just can't even see it, you know, that you would, any other way that you could do it without being labeled, you know, as the devil himself. So,
well, I think unless it's a real fire breathing lefty with some real question marks in the background, and I don't think that'll be who gets picked. You know, the Democrats are going to probably, I would be surprised if there's any Democratic opposition to the Biden pick. And that pretty much assures that they'll get confirmed. And like you say, I think it's probably, if it is, particularly if it's an African-American woman who's appointed, which I think is likely to be the case, that's not a hill you're going to want to die on. She's going to get confirmed anyway. And
yeah.
you're only going to get attacked as having, you know, racist motives if you really put up significant opposition. Now, I think that there will be some tough questions, and I think that a lot of Republicans, I don't, you know, whoever Biden picks, are probably going to vote not to confirm. But, you know, again, the vitriol and the dirt digging and just the contention that you see when a Republican is appointed to the Supreme Court, particularly – you know, as we saw with Brett Kavanaugh, and, you know, digging back, you know, Hank, how would you like to go back 30 years to what we were doing in college or something and have someone dig that up and try to throw that? I mean, when you look at what Kavanaugh had to go through, Clarence Thomas, a little different. But, I mean, going back to high school and college and parties and things like that, it's just amazing.
And you will not
see that happen with whoever's picked. By Joe Biden to be
What if President Trump had nominated a female black judge for the you know, I mean, they would have figured out a way to go after. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah,
if
you recall with Amy Coney Barrett, who's obviously white female. There was, other than the fact that they didn't like the fact that he was making the appointment, you know, a month or so before the election, if she was getting confirmed, they couldn't really touch her.
Yeah.
And they didn't really try. I think there was probably nothing there, but you didn't see them go after her the way they went after Brett Kavanaugh or the way they went after Clarence Thomas or the way they went after Robert Bork. The term to bork was what, right?
Yeah.
That comes, that verb was created, after what happened to him during his confirmation hearings and so on. But yeah, so, you know, it's just not, like you say, it's just not a hill that I think a lot of Republicans are going to want to die on. And I don't think they would fight quite as dirty as what we've seen with, like the Brett Kavanaugh case comes to mind, particularly Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
It's not a hill that they're going to die on when it looks like, you know, there's confirmation will be inevitable. And part of the reason you don't want to die on this hill is because this is just a liberal that's going to be replacing a liberal. It's not going to change the balance of the court. If it was going to change the balance of the court, I think it would be a lot more contention maybe than I think what's going to happen here. So Republicans don't need to, like you say, die on this hill.
I don't see any point in it, really. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, let's put it this way. I think, unfortunately, often the Republican Party sacrifices their people, eats their young, whatever you want to say, when certain stuff happens. But on the same token, there's a certain point where you got to have a little bit of class. I mean, you don't have to agree with whoever the nominee is politically, but if the nominee is qualified, and as you mentioned about Justice Breyer, was certainly qualified. You didn't have to like his politics, but he was certainly qualified. Well, then you really can't argue beyond that. You know, like it or not, you just can't. You know, I mean,
used to be the standard. You didn't look into the judicial philosophy so much or their political beliefs. Were they qualified? Were they competent? Were they up to the job? And if they were, the presumption was. And that's why you saw people like for instance, Breyer back in when he was confirmed, I think in 1993, it was an 87-9 vote. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it was like 91-6 or something like that. I believe Scalia was unanimously approved. It used to be that way, but then starting really the Clarence Thomas nomination kind of changed everything. And after that, it's been like a pulling teeth every time, particularly if it's a Republican appointee. And there's usually, like I said, it's just when it's a Democrat appointee, it seems to be less vitriol. But I think that he's going to appoint somebody, particularly let's say it is this Ketanji Brown Jackson. There's not going to be any real argument that she's not, a distinguished jurist who's probably, qualified to serve on the court. But she'll be very liberal.
Boy, he made a point on here. The only thing you really could have gone more than a black woman would be a black trans woman.
Judge pool falls into that category.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe there's somebody I don't know of. But let's get back to the real thing we're talking about here, which is that elections have consequences.
Yep.
It had consequences for the Democrats when Trump won, and we got three pretty solid conservatives on the court, I think. And of course, with Biden getting elected, the expectation is, particularly on the left among Democrats, I mean, I certainly understand it, that he will appoint a progressive who will be a strong liberal voice on the court, and that's exactly, I think, what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of sad that it's gotten to that point, but by the same token, you also have to, I mean, like you said, elections have consequences. You also have to remember, I mean, these are people that are supposed to be interpreting the Constitution, and there are certain things, I mean, there are certain decisions that have come over, you know, the last 20 years that really make you wonder. I mean, you know, forget just not just Obamacare, but other stuff. I mean, and part of it has been the politicization. I mean, 2000 was not a big help to this country in terms of, you know, the courts and the elections and all that. I mean, you know, there are still people that say 22 years later or 21 and a half years later that George W. Bush was only president because the Supreme Court made him president, you know,
right.
You know.
And that's another thing. The courts have become, you can argue the courts have become too important. They become political. You know, you talk about like legislating from the bench and, you know, sort of rule by judicial fiat because, over what's happened in jurisprudence and Supreme Court jurisprudence over the last 56 years, you've seen the doctrine and by the way, Breyer was a big proponent of it. I meant to touch on this a little bit of the quote living Constitution unquote, which is that we don't just look at what's in the Constitution. The Constitution evolved sort of some sort of form of evolutionary transformation over the years as the mores of society change. And so you go in and you find constitutional rights that were never in the Constitution, but which we're now going to imply because we have a living Constitution. The problem with that, of course, is that who makes that decision? And when that happens, I mean, if you can do that, then anyone can just kind of invent things. And it becomes a little dangerous. But there's a large strain of jurisprudence, perhaps even a dominant strain, that believes that that's what you have to do. I've always been more of a strict constructionist myself. I think if it's, you know, not in the text of the Constitution, it's supposed to be for the it's supposed to be for the people to decide through their elected representatives. But that's not a view that's universally held in the
And it's also, and I would say this on the left, they pick and choose. You know, they've recently, you know, before they finally, they were going after Manchin and Sinema with this whole the filibuster's not in the Constitution. You know, and if somebody had to point out, yeah, well, there's a lot of other stuff that's not in the Constitution either, that gets done ritually or whatever, and you know, it gets taken for granted.
Actually,
you know,
in a way, though, it is, and here's why: the Constitution expressly talks about the Senate and House, you know, being the final word on the rules for each body, and that's where the filibuster comes from—the rules of the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, she made it, you know, they made it sound like, oh, it's not in the, there's nothing in the Constitution that protect, you know, with the filibuster. And it's like, well, yeah, there's a lot of other stuff that's not in there, like, you know, insider trading by senators and Congress people. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's not in the Constitution that.
Well,
you know,
and, you know, the big case that's going to be coming down in June, and there's a lot of speculation that they're finally going to maybe overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, Roe versus Wade, you know, is based on this generalized principle of the right to privacy, which actually came from an earlier case called Griswold versus Connecticut that dealt with laws banning contraception. And in that case, they came up with this very, I think, somewhat tortured reasoning idea of there are certain specific rights of privacy in the Constitution, particularly the Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And from these specific rights, there are in between these penumbras that other rights, privacy rights, are implied or emanate. And it's just basically a way of saying getting to a position where you can invent. I mean, this is my opinion. It's worth it. You know, two cents and a dollar get you a cup of coffee at McDonald's, but it's from these kinds of living amorphous
sort of principles of constitutional interpretation that you then develop general rights to privacy, which then include rights to abortion and other
right.
types, you know, rights to gay marriage, which I have no personal problem with gay marriage. I don't think the Constitution talks about it that much.
Yeah, it doesn't talk because it doesn't talk about it doesn't talk about any marriage. I mean, that's just it. You know, that's what's so disheartening about.
The states would make that decision through their elected representatives, elected by the people in a democratic society. But the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, has found these rights to privacy, and from that generalized rights, they have created rights to abortion and saying that states cannot prevent gay marriage. Now, as I said, I don't personally have a problem with gay marriage at all. But the question is not whether I believe it or support it. The question is whether or not the Constitution mandates these rights.
Right. Well, you know, it makes you wonder, like, for instance, on the mandate being overturned, on the private employer mandate being overturned, you know, was that on the basis of, you know, I mean, it's not even clear anymore. Was that on the basis, or were they thinking on the basis of that's really the legislature's job, you know, the House and Senate, or was it that they, you know, on that privacy issue, you know, because remember, HIPAA was so important when Bill Clinton was president, and he didn't want to give up medical records, you know, while he was running for president. I mean, I always called HIPAA the Bill Clinton Protection Bill, but yet, you know, with this vaccination stuff, you know, HIPAA be damned. I mean, I've never seen more abuse of HIPAA than we've seen in the last 2 years during this whole COVID stuff. I mean, it's like HIPAA doesn't even exist. And it's amazing to me how it's just absolutely been destroyed, but yet it's like it's in our, you know, it's in our best interest, it's in safety. You know, where is that? I don't even get where it's coming from, you know? And then they say on the other side, with the mandate for healthcare workers, oh, remember, the first rule is do no harm. Well, okay, that's great, but are we sure that you're doing no harm when you're vaccinating everybody with a vaccine that hasn't necessarily been time tested? I mean, I just don't know where they're going sometimes.
I mean, and this is where it comes into play when whoever's appointed to the Supreme Court, and it'll come up at the hearings, and that is, you know, I mean, if you think something's a good idea, that doesn't necessarily mean that we imply that it's a right created under the Constitution, but that happens, I think, to some extent far too often. And, you know, I remember, you know, I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican. I think I pretty much am. I, you know, some things by and large. But when I was in working many years ago, a young law clerk, this was like back, I think, 1997, worked on a case that challenged the constitutionality of the I don't know if you remember back when Clinton became president, he passed a bunch of tax increases. Some of these tax increases were, you know, as part of his economic program, right? Some of these tax increases were retroactive, particularly I think there was the gift taxes and a couple other taxes. It's been a long time now. And so these were challenged on that basis and on the basis of, you know, for other reasons. And so that I worked on that case, and we decided that – well, I shouldn't say we. The judge that I was working for decided that the law was constitutional. Now, when I was working on that case, I don't think I liked the idea of all the tax increases that Clinton wanted to do. But the question wasn't whether I liked it. The question is whether it was constitutional and whether, you know, these were laws passed by Congress and whether they comported with the what was in the Constitution. And it did. So the judge's job then is to stop right there. Sometimes that doesn't happen. And I think it's important when we're looking at who's going to be put on the Supreme Court, you know, just how far they're willing to go beyond what a judge's role should be, which is to just make, you know, apply the law and not try to make the law.
Yeah. Well, and that's been a thing. A big problem is that people always
and
talk about legislating from the bench.
Isn't that the crux of this all? That's what the crux of this is all about when you talk about people being appointed to the Supreme Court. A lot of people don't oppose the Republican appointees because that's exactly what they will do. They'll just apply the law. They won't create or honor rights that are created out of whole cloth based on concepts of a living constitution.
Right. Well, one of the people in the chat room bringing it, boy, points out in California, for instance, you've had it where they voted on things. You know, the state, the voters have voted on stuff, and it gets overturned. And it's like, how does that happen? But and then other places where they vote on it, and they won't even hear the case. You know, I mean, it seems. I mean, and that's why people, I think, get disillusioned. Is that, you know, they'll hear this case but not that case. They'll overturn this case but not that case. I mean, even the mandate issue. You know, I mean, I think I know where they were going with that, in that, you know, look, it's the federal government at that point, you know, if it belongs to the federal government, then the federal government can rule on it, so to speak. I don't necessarily agree, but I at least see where they're coming from. But I think in other stuff, people see it. People see a state votership that votes this way and votes to not provide, as an example, I think Proposition 8 in California might be the one I'm thinking of, where they voted not to allow illegals to be getting state funds for all this different stuff. But then guess what happened? The state Supreme Court just said, no, that's not right. You can't do it. Well, it was unconstitutional. How did it make the ballot then? How come it was never challenged before that and taken off the ballot? And I think people get disillusioned with that. And I think that's, you know.
Well, they do. And so, I'll give you a better example than that real quick, too. My home state of Iowa, I've been following this a little bit. Iowa's been a state that's been pretty much, you know, from the get-go, we're not going to have all these mandates. We're not going to have all these lockdowns. We're just going to move on and try to get through this COVID stuff. Well, they recently, I think it was last year, they passed, the state legislature passed a law signed by the governor that banned mask mandates. And particularly, they said schools cannot impose mask mandates on kids. And, you know, you're not going to let you do this. Well, a group of students or a group of parents, purportedly parents, I'm they probably are, but I mean, this is how this thing happens, of disabled kids sued under federal law, went into federal court in Des Moines and said that, you know, this can't be allowed to stand because it places, you know, kids with disabilities are particularly at risk to COVID. So if you get rid of the mask mandate, they're being prejudiced, and this violates federal law, particularly, I think, the ADA they cited.
Yeah.
Court agreed with them and struck down a law passed by the representatives of the people of Iowa who were duly elected and the governor who's duly elected because this one judge knows better. And I just, you know, I mean, it's stuff like that really gets people going. Now this case is now up in the – I think the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we'll see what happens. It could eventually go up to the Supreme Court. But, you know, you're seeing this around the country, right? When the new governor of Virginia was elected, he's just in a big fight now with local school districts because he's saying, you know, no more mask mandates in school.
Yep, and they're suing
him. You know, I think it's really tough on 5-year-old kids to have to wear masks 8 hours a day, and they're pretty much invulnerable to serious illness from COVID or giving it. And yet, you know, they're opposing these things. I think it's almost a form of child abuse. That's my personal opinion. But the point I'm making is that the legislature and the governor, you know, duly elected by the people of Iowa, had passed the law. It was a state law. And a federal judge comes in and overturns it on rather obscure basis that, you know, this discriminates adversely more against kids with handicaps and violates the I think it was the ADA, I'm not positive, but it's some federal law, which I think is a questionable basis, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So they throw the law out. One judge does this.
Yeah, and that's kind of scary. Speaking of, you know, I was talking earlier about Neil Young, Spotify, I guess, finally did remove his stuff. Are you a Spotify listener or not?
I'm not, but I've been following that a little bit, and you know, I am kind of a Neil Young fan, and you know, wonder about this guy. By the way, I have to say, I'm really disappointed that you didn't play any Meatloaf.
At the very least,
you should have played. You took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, it's harder to upload to Blog Talk Radio right now because they've. I don't know what's happening, but some of the stuff that I used to download, they're not. So, and I, you know, I don't hate Meatloaf, but I wasn't his biggest fan or anything like that. So, but anyway, no, Spotify said
big in high school, particular, in late 70s,
and college, yeah, but no, Spotify took Neil Young off. And he was. They said he had 2.4 million followers and 6 million monthly listeners, but, I mean, that still pales in comparison to what Rogan has. I mean, you know, but, yeah, I was finding it interesting that Spotify just said, okay, good, then go ahead and leave. That's, you know, that's the way it goes. So I just think that's kind of interesting that they allowed it, you know, that they took a stand, you know, that they didn't, you know, they didn't buckle in and say, you know, well, Joe, you might have to tone it down or, you know, temper it back or whatever. So I think that's good. So anyway, hey, well, thanks for being on. I'm gonna finish off with my final polysports thing, but thanks for being on and giving some insight into how the whole process works and what we can expect. And,
sure thing, Hank. We'll see how this unfolds over the coming months.
Yep, and go Hawks tomorrow night, man.
Yep, go Hawks. You bet it.
Okay, talk to you later.
Okay.
And one of my roommates from college, Hawkeye Mike, brilliant mind. As I said one time, this guy, he's always been interested in the law and learning, you know, the law and, you know, having worked in the law, having been a lawyer and then worked in the federal judge, clerking in a federal judge's office. So he's seen a lot of what's happening. And, you know, like, as we said, you know, judges legislating from the bench has become more of a problem, but in the end of it, you know, it's really, it is whether you like it or not, it's Dopey Joe's nomination to make, should he make it to the end of Justice Breyer's term. So interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. And yeah, I agree. You know, I can't believe that if he's not retiring till the end, that somebody leaked it. Dopey Joe tried to walk it back by saying, "Oh, when he makes that announcement, we'll be, you know, we'll listen," or whatever. So anyway, I told you I was going to get back to this poly sports bit. Curt Schilling is the poster child of the victim of new wokeness cancel culture. Now, as I mentioned, he twice reached over 70%. Twice reached over 70% in voting for the Hall of Fame. Now, as it was pointed out, every person who has reached 70% within their first, you know, couple of years, has always gotten in. It seems to be the, you know, once you get 70%, you're going to get the 75%. Now, he may be the first to do that who did not eventually get in. I'm pretty sure he's the first. Now, his on-field numbers were solid. 216 wins, 3 World Series titles, several examples of grit and toughness not shown by most modern pitchers. Like, remember the bleeding ankle game? But Curt Schilling was guilty. Guilty of what, you might ask? No, he wasn't a performance-enhancing drug user that we know of. He never bet on the game that we know of. He never threw a ball at an umpire. He never instigated any bench-clearing brawls. So what did he do? I'll tell you what he did. He spoke out. Remember, he spoke out against sports journalists at one point. He supported conservative ideas, including supporting, at times, Donald J. Trump. He made, quote, incendiary comments, which resulted in his being fired by ESPN. Now, when he fell short last year, Curt Schilling asked to be removed from the ballot. Now, for whatever reason, the committee didn't honor that request, which is kind of odd, because if it was just some guy who was liberal or even quiet and noncommittal, politically speaking, I'm sure they would have obliged. But remember, when Richard Nixon wanted to resign, they wouldn't hear of it. When he wanted to surrender his law license, they wouldn't hear of it. When Bill Clinton wanted to surrender his law license, no problem. Yeah, Curt Schilling asked to be taken off the ballot, and he wasn't. But, you know, like I said, with the new woke cancel culture, they had to make an example of him. And while I'd like to think that's reflected in his reduced support, he only got 58.6% this time versus the required 75. I'm guessing only a portion honored his request by leaving him off. I'm guessing the rest, they just wanted to punish him. Now, here's the thing. There's no limit to how many can be voted in a class. Voting committee, for whatever reason, seems to self-impose a limit, but they could theoretically vote in every candidate if each voter chose to. Now, in this case, I'm not sure Schilling has such great numbers to get in, honestly. Was he a great player? Absolutely. But the numbers, they're not that outstanding. 216 wins, I mean, there are a lot of 300-game winners out there. There are even some that haven't made it in, I think. So no, but when the articles about him not getting in mention his political controversies, while almost ignoring the performance-enhancing drug scandals of the others, yeah, it's political as hell. It's political as hell. So we're going to end with this tonight. I could go through all the memes that I've seen, all the jokes, all the rumors aside. But after what we've seen this week from Dopey Joe, I'm pretty sure there's one argument I can make that you cannot successfully argue against. That is this. The toughest job in the world right now would have to be being Dopey Joe's American Sign Language interpreter, given that guy's idiocy. That's the toughest job in the world right now. Well, folks, it's it for me this week. Said what I wanted to say, heard what I wanted to hear. Got Mike on to talk about the Breyer thing. Interesting stuff, no doubt. And so for that, I'm going to send you off with some good music. Can't decide what I'm going to send you off with, but I know. I'm going to send you off with one that I played a couple weeks ago with the death of a guy from this group. Let's just end with this one. And have a good week and have a good weekend. Folks, before we cut out, I want to thank those of you that were here. I forgot to thank you all. Several of you in the chat room, T. Bodie, Bringing a Boy, Indie Hawk, Mike for being on the show, a couple of listeners. I saw Big Sister on there and Sue and a couple of numbers I don't recognize. Thanks for being here. Have a great weekend. Have a great week. Be safe. And remember, back here next week, 5:30 next Wednesday. Good night, all.